A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He was listening to Herman's account of the Poppleberry family history, and it got him thinking about the broader immigration pattern. Specifically, how a wild number of Americans trace their lineage back to just a handful of passengers on a single crossing, the Mayflower, or one of those early Ellis Island waves. He's asking how that actually worked, how a few hundred people became millions of descendants, and whether it's really as concentrated as it sounds.
It is, and the numbers are genuinely staggering. Let's start with the Mayflower, because that's the one people toss around most often. The ship landed in 1620 with 102 passengers. About half of them died that first winter. So we're talking about roughly 50 people who survived to have children. And yet the General Society of Mayflower Descendants estimates there are 35 million living Americans who can trace their lineage to at least one of those passengers.
35 million from 50 people.
From 50 people. That's a 700,000-to-1 multiplier across 4 centuries. If you do the math, it works out to roughly 1 in 10 Americans. And that's not some fuzzy genealogy club claim. The Mayflower Society has verified lineages. They've done the paperwork. They have historians cross-referencing birth records, marriage certificates, wills. This isn't legend, it's documentation.
The question is how? Because on its face, that multiplier sounds impossible. 50 people don't become 35 million without something structural going on.
Right, and the structure is what's interesting. The first thing to understand is that the Mayflower passengers arrived at the very start of a population that would expand into a continent. They were early. That's the single biggest factor. If you arrive in 1620 and your descendants keep moving westward with each generation, you're not just multiplying. You're multiplying into empty land, into new towns, into an agricultural economy that rewards large families. The median Mayflower passenger who left descendants had something like 7 or 8 children who survived to adulthood. In England at the time, the number was closer to 3 or 4.
It's not just that they had kids. It's that the kids survived, and then had their own large families, and so on, in an environment where the usual brakes on population growth, land scarcity, food shortages, dense urban disease, weren't applying yet.
And the generations compound fast. Let's say a Mayflower couple has 8 children. Each of those 8 marries and has 8 more. By the 4th generation, you're looking at thousands of descendants. By the 6th generation, hundreds of thousands. By the 8th, millions. It's exponential math, and 400 years gives you roughly 14 to 16 generations depending on how you count. 16 doublings of anything gets big.
The marriage patterns matter here too, don't they? Because if Mayflower descendants mostly married other Mayflower descendants, you'd get pedigree collapse. The tree folds in on itself. But that's not what happened.
Quite the opposite. Mayflower descendants married into the broader population constantly. That's how you get the dispersion. A Brewster descendant marries a farmer who arrived in 1750. Their children carry the line, but now it's blended into a much wider gene pool. By the 19th century, Mayflower ancestry is threaded through New England so thoroughly that it's almost background radiation. You might have it and not know it.
Which means the 35 million figure is probably an undercount, because it only includes people who can document the line. There are almost certainly millions more who descend from a Mayflower passenger, but don't have the paper trail.
That's the consensus among genealogists, yes. The Mayflower Society requires documented proof, birth, marriage, death records at every step. They're rigorous. But the actual number, if you could wave a magic wand and test everyone's DNA with a perfect genealogical timeline attached, would probably be substantially higher. Some estimates put it closer to 50 or 60 million.
Of course there are.
The DNA companies have actually started to quantify this. Ancestry.com published data a few years ago showing that Mayflower descendants are concentrated in New England, as you'd expect, Massachusetts, Maine, Vermont. But there are significant clusters in Utah, of all places, and in the Pacific Northwest. Utah makes sense when you think about it. large families, detailed genealogical record keeping for religious reasons, and a lot of 19th century migration from New England.
The Mormon Pioneer Trail as a Mayflower distribution network.
Brigham Young was himself a Mayflower descendant, through the Fuller line, I believe.
That's the Mayflower. Let's talk about Ellis Island, because the prompt specifically mentioned both. Ellis Island is a very different story. Different era, different scale, different meth.
Ellis Island opened in 1892, and I should note, your great-great-grandfather Arthur Poppleberry arrived in New York in 1891, so he just missed it. He would have come through Castle Garden, which was the predecessor immigration station at the Battery. Ellis Island took over the following year and processed its first immigrant, a 15-year-old Irish girl named Annie Moore, on January 1, 1892.
The volume was enormous.
Between 1892 and 1924, Ellis Island processed roughly 12 million immigrants. At its peak in 1907, it was handling more than a million people in a single year. On April 17th of that year, they processed 11,747 people in one day. That's a small city walking through a single building.
11,747. That's not a typo.
Not a typo. And here's the thing about the Ellis Island wave that's different from the Mayflower. The Mayflower was a founder population, small, early, and then exponential growth over centuries. Ellis Island was a mass migration into an already established country. The U.S. population in 1890 was 63 million. By 1920, it was 106 million. The immigrants didn't just add to the population, they reproduced within it. And their arrival was concentrated enough that a huge share of today's Americans can trace to that window.
I've seen estimates that 40% of Americans can trace at least one ancestor through Ellis Island.
That's the commonly cited figure, roughly 40%, which would be about 130 million people today. The Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation has done extensive work on this. They maintain a database of 65 million arrival records, searchable by name. And that 40% number keeps getting cited because the math broadly supports it. If 12 million immigrants arrived and each had, conservatively, three children who survived to reproduce, and those descendants intermarried with the broader population, you hit the 100 million plus range within three or four generations.
It's not as clean as the Mayflower math, because Ellis Island immigrants arrived at different times, from different places, and dispersed differently. The Mayflower passengers all landed together in one spot, and their descendants radiated outward in a pattern you can map. Ellis Island was a continuous churn.
Right, and the intermarriage patterns were different. Mayflower descendants in the 17th and 18th centuries mostly married within New England Protestant communities. Ellis Island immigrants, Italians, Poles, Russian Jews, Greeks, Slovaks, often married within their own ethnic communities for the first generation, sometimes the second, and then dispersed. So the genealogical web looks different. It's more layered than the Mayflower web.
There's also a selection effect in who gets counted. The Mayflower Society has a clear, documented standard. You prove descent from a specific list of passengers. Ellis Island doesn't have a society with equivalent prestige. Nobody brags about being a Castle Garden descendant at dinner parties.
No, but there's an emotional resonance to Ellis Island that the Mayflower doesn't quite capture. The Mayflower is about founding mythology. Pilgrims, Plymouth Rock, the first Thanksgiving. Ellis Island is about the great-grandparent with a foreign accent who worked in a sweatshop and saved enough to bring the rest of the family over. It's a different register of American identity. And interestingly, both are heavily mythologized.
Say more about that.
The Mayflower mythology overstates the religious freedom narrative. The pilgrims weren't fleeing persecution so much as they were seeking a place to establish their own rigid religious community, which they had already done in the Netherlands, by the way. They left Leiden because they worried their children were becoming too Dutch, and the Ellis Island mythology overstates the open arms, welcome. The inspection process was invasive, the medical exams were humiliating, and about 2% of arrivals were turned back, often for reasons that look cruel by modern standards. A child traveling alone could be deported. A woman traveling without a male relative could be detained.
The famous chalk marks on the shoulder.
Yes, doctors would mark immigrants' clothing with chalk letters indicating suspected conditions. H for heart, L for lameness, X for mental illness. The immigrant would then be pulled aside for further examination, and if they failed, they'd be sent back at the shipping company's expense. The shipping companies, by the way, were financially liable for return passages, which meant they started doing their own pre-screening at the port of departure. So by the time someone reached Ellis Island, they'd already passed one filter.
Which means the Ellis Island seed population wasn't random. It was pre-selected for health, for apparent fitness, for having at least enough money or connections to pass the initial screen. And that selection would have downstream effects on who reproduced and prospered.
And that's one of those knock-on effects that most popular histories miss. The Ellis Island population wasn't America's tired, poor, huddled masses in an unfiltered sense. The poorest, the sickest, the most desperate, many of them never made it onto the ship, or they were turned back at the port. The ones who got through and stayed were already a filtered sample.
Both stories, Mayflower and Ellis Island, involve a founder effect, but of different kinds. The Mayflower was a tiny group that got a 400-year head start. Ellis Island was a massive wave that was filtered for viability and then multiplied within an existing population structure.
There's a third layer to this that the prob didn't explicitly ask about, but that ties both stories together, the colonial migration that happened between the Mayflower and Ellis Island. Between 1620 and 1775, about 400,000 people immigrated to the American colonies. The vast majority were English, with significant numbers of Scots, Irish, Germans, and enslaved Africans. That 400,000 became about 2.5 million by the time of the first census in 1790.
Another founder population, larger than the Mayflower but still small relative to what came later.
And because they arrived before the population explosion, their genealogical footprint is disproportionately large. If your ancestor arrived in 1650, they had 200 years of American demographic expansion ahead of them before the Ellis Island wave even started. That's 8 to 10 generations of multiplying into an expanding frontier.
Which is why so many Americans with deep colonial roots have family trees that look like a tangled thicket of the same 200 surnames. You go back far enough, and everyone's a Winslow, or a Bradford, or a Brewster, or a Standish.
Or a Poppleberry, in my case, though we were late to the party. 1891 is practically yesterday in genealogical terms. But to your point, the colonial intermarriage pattern is so dense that if you have one Mayflower ancestor, you probably have 3 or 4. The lines cross and recross. Genealogists call it pedigree collapse, but in the American colonial context, it's really pedigree braiding.
Let's talk about what this means for the average American who does a DNA test and gets a surprising result. Because the prompt is partly about this experience, the discovery that you're connected to a handful of people on a specific ship.
The DNA testing companies have transformed this. 20 years ago, proving Mayflower descent meant years of archival research. Now you can get a test, upload your results to a genealogical database, and within days you might find a documented match that connects you to a specific passenger. The databases cross-reference DNA segments with family trees. If you share a segment of DNA with someone who has a documented Mayflower line, and you can place that segment on the same chromosome, the inference is strong.
There's a catch, isn't there? The DNA companies are working with probabilistic models.
Yes, and the farther back you go, the noisier the signal. At 10 or 12 generations of separation, you share only a tiny fraction of your DNA with any given ancestor, and in many cases, you share none that's detectable. The math is counterintuitive. You have 2 parents, 4 grandparents, 8 great-grandparents. By the time you go back 10 generations, you have 1,024 ancestors in that generation alone. But your genome only has so many segments to go around. Some ancestors drop out of your detectable DNA entirely, even though they're genealogically your ancestors.
The DNA test might tell you you're not a Mayflower descendant, even if you are.
DNA testing for deep ancestry works best when you can triangulate with multiple living relatives. One person's test might miss the Mayflower segment, 10 cousins' tests might catch it. That's why the paper trail still matters. The Mayflower Society doesn't accept DNA evidence as sufficient for membership. They want documents.
Which raises an interesting question. If the documentation is what counts, and documentation favors certain kinds of families, literate, property-owning, record-keeping, then the 35 million Mayflower descendants number is partly a measure of who kept good records.
That's a fair point, and it applies even more strongly to the Ellis Island side. Ellis Island records are extensive. Ship manifests, inspection logs, naturalization papers, but they're not complete. Names were misspelled, records were lost, fires destroyed archives. The Ellis Island Immigration Station itself burned down in 1897. All the records from the first 5 years were destroyed. They rebuilt and reopened in 1900, but anything from 1892 to 1897 is gone.
Your great-grandfather Arthur, arriving in 1891, missed the fire and missed the records.
He came through Castle Garden, which kept its own records, but Castle Garden's archives are patchy compared to Ellis Island's. The point is, when we say 40% of Americans can trace an ancestor through Ellis Island, we're talking about the traceable ones. The actual number, if you include people whose ancestors' records were lost or never created, is unknowable.
Both numbers, 35 million Mayflower, 130 million Ellis Island, are floors, not ceilings.
And they're not mutually exclusive. Plenty of Americans have both. A Mayflower descendant whose later ancestors married into a family that arrived through Ellis Island. The genealogical layers stack.
Let's go back to the mechanism, because I think this is what the prompt is really driving at. How does a founder population seed millions of descendants? You mentioned exponential math, early arrival, and large families. But there's something else, isn't there? The geographic expansion pattern.
This is where it gets fascinating. The United States experienced something almost unique in demographic history, a sustained, multi-century expansion into a continent with relatively low population density. The frontier didn't just move. It kept moving, generation after generation, from the Atlantic coast to the Appalachians to the Midwest to the Great Plains to the Pacific. And each wave of expansion created new towns, new farmland, new economic opportunities that rewarded large families.
The Mayflower descendants were positioned at the front of that wave.
At the very front. The typical pattern was, a family would settle in Massachusetts, stay for two or three generations, then a branch would move to upstate New York or Ohio, stay for two generations, then move to Illinois or Michigan, then to Oregon or California. Each move created a new node of the family tree, and each node produced its own branches. By 1900, a single Mayflower passenger could have descendants in all 45 states.
They weren't just moving geographically. They were moving into different social strata. The Mayflower descendant who moved west might become a farmer, a merchant, a schoolteacher, a politician. The family tree diversifies both spatially and economically.
Which makes the genealogical web even denser. If a descendant family in Ohio prospers and has 10 children, and those 10 children marry into 10 different families across the Midwest, suddenly you've got Mayflower ancestry threaded through dozens of communities that have no idea they're connected to Plymouth.
There's a name for this in population genetics, isn't there? The founder effect.
Yes, but the American case is unusual because it's not a closed population. The classic founder effect is something like the Amish or French Canadians, a small group that stays relatively endogamous and multiplies rapidly. The Mayflower descendants didn't stay endogamous, they intermarried constantly, so it's a founder effect with outbreeding, which accelerates the dispersion rather than containing it.
It's the opposite of a genetic isolate. It's a genetic sprinkler system.
A genetic sprinkler system. The founder population provides the initial genetic material, but then it's broadcast across the entire population through intermarriage. And because the American population grew so fast, from about 4 million in 1790 to over 300 million today, the founder signal got amplified along with everything else.
Let's put some numbers on that population growth, because I think people don't appreciate how extreme it was. 4 million to 300 million in a little over two centuries.
The U.S. population in the first census, 1790, was 3.9 million. By 1850, it was 23 million. By 1900, it was 76 million. By 1950, it was 151 million. And today, it's roughly 340 million. That's an 87-fold increase. For comparison, England's population over the same period grew about fivefold. France grew about 2.5-fold.
The American demographic expansion is the engine that makes the Mayflower 35 million possible. If the country had grown at English rates, you'd be looking at maybe 2 million descendants, not 35 million.
The Mayflower passengers happened to arrive at the very beginning of the largest sustained population expansion in modern history, in a country that encouraged immigration, intermarriage, and westward movement. It's a perfect storm for genealogical multiplication.
The Ellis Island wave arrived at a different point in that curve. not at the beginning, but during the steepest part of the climb. The U.S. population roughly doubled between 1890 and 1920, from 63 million to 106 million. So the Ellis Island immigrants were multiplying into a population that was itself multiplying rapidly.
And they arrived in concentrated bursts. The peak years, 1905 to 1907, saw more than 1 million immigrants per year. Those immigrants were predominantly young adults in their prime childbearing years. They married, had children, and those children reached adulthood just as the U.S. was entering another period of economic expansion. The timing was incredibly favorable.
If you were designing a system to maximize genealogical dispersion, you'd want early arrival, large families, high child survival, geographic expansion, intermarriage with the broader population, and a rapidly growing host population. The Mayflower checks every box. Ellis Island checks most of them, just with a later start.
That's why both have produced these enormous descendant counts. The mechanisms are the same, just operating on different timescales and starting populations.
There's something almost disorienting about this. The idea that 102 people on a wooden ship 400 years ago could have 35 million living descendants. It makes the past feel less past. Those people aren't distant historical figures. They're genetic ancestors of 1 in 10 people you pass on the street.
The same is true for the Ellis Island wave. 12 million people, most of them poor, many of them illiterate in their own languages, arriving in the country that didn't particularly want them, and now their descendants number over 100 million. It's one of the largest demographic transformations in history, and it happened in just 3 or 4 generations.
The prompt mentioned that this was kind of an immigrant population seed for what later blossomed into American families. That's exactly right. The seed metaphor is apt. A seed is small, but it contains the genetic instructions for the whole plant, and if you plant it in rich soil with plenty of water and sunlight, it can produce something vastly larger than itself.
The soil and water and sunlight, in this case, being the North American continent and the economic and political conditions that encourage settlement and reproduction.
Let's talk about the political dimension for a moment, because it's impossible to discuss American immigration history without touching on the restrictions that eventually came. The Ellis Island era didn't just happen in a vacuum. It ended, abruptly, with the Immigration Act of 1924.
The Johnson-Reed Act. It established national origin quotas that heavily favored Northern and Western Europe and severely restricted immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, not to mention Asia. The quotas were explicitly designed to preserve the ethnic composition of the United States as it stood in 1890, before the big Ellis Island waves from Italy, Russia, and Poland. It was a direct legislative response to the demographic transformation that Ellis Island represented.
The seed population was deliberately managed. The door was opened, 12 million people came through, and then the door was slammed shut because the political establishment looked at what had happened and decided they didn't want more of it.
That's the uncomfortable part of the story. The Ellis Island immigration wave succeeded demographically. Millions of descendants, deep integration into American life, but it also provoked a nativist backlash that shut down mass immigration for 40 years. The 1924 Act wasn't fully dismantled until 1965, so the descendants of Ellis Island immigrants grew up in a country that had, in effect, decided their grandparents shouldn't have been let in.
Which adds a layer of irony to the current veneration of Ellis Island. The same families whose ancestors were greeted with chalk marks and suspicion are now held up as the quintessential American immigration story. It's a post-hoc embrace.
History gets sanded down. The rough edges get smoothed. Ellis Island becomes a heritage theme park instead of what it was, a processing center that could be terrifying for the people who passed through it.
The Mayflower has undergone a similar smoothing. The Pilgrims were religious separatists who believed the Church of England was irredeemably corrupt. They weren't pluralists. They didn't come to establish religious freedom for everyone. They came to establish religious freedom for themselves. And within a generation, they were exiling people like Roger Williams for having the wrong theological views.
Roger Williams founded Rhode Island specifically because he was banished from Massachusetts for advocating religious tolerance and fair treatment of Native Americans. The Mayflower mythology conveniently forgets that part.
Both stories, Mayflower and Ellis Island, are more complicated than the popular versions. But the demographic fact remains. They were founder populations of extraordinary success. 50 people became 35 million. 12 million became over 100 million. The math is real, even if the mythology is selective.
The lesson for anyone doing their own genealogy is, if you have American ancestry that goes back before the Civil War, especially in New England, there's a decent chance you're connected to one of these founder populations. If your ancestors arrived through Ellis Island, the odds are even higher, simply because the numbers were so large.
The prompt asks specifically about how this immigrant population seed worked. I think the answer is, it worked through a combination of early arrival, high fertility, high child survival, geographic expansion, intermarriage, and a demographic environment that amplified everything. The Mayflower was the seed that had the longest time to grow. Ellis Island was the seed that had the largest initial mass. Both produced enormous trees.
Both produced genealogical records that are now being digitized and connected in ways that would have been unimaginable even 20 years ago. The Mayflower Society has put decades of research online. The Ellis Island Foundation has searchable ship manifests. FamilySearch has billions of records. The amateur genealogist today has more tools than the professional had in 1990.
Which means the numbers will probably keep going up. As more records are digitized and more people submit DNA samples, the documented descendant counts for both Mayflower and Ellis Island will increase. The 35 million and the 130 million are snapshots, not final figures.
There's something satisfying about that. These people, the pilgrims on the Mayflower, the immigrants at Ellis Island, they couldn't have imagined their genealogical footprint. They were just trying to survive, to build lives, to give their children something better. And 400 years later, or 120 years later, their descendants number in the tens of millions. It's a kind of quiet immortality.
Provided you kept good records.
Immortality has a paperwork requirement. To wrap up the core question, yes, it really is that concentrated. The Mayflower passengers are the genealogical ancestors of roughly 1 in 10 Americans. Ellis Island immigrants are the ancestors of roughly 4 in 10. The overlap between those groups is significant. And the mechanism is demographic. Early arrival plus large families, plus geographic expansion, plus intermarriage multiplied across generations, produces numbers that feel impossible but are mathematically straightforward.
If you're listening to this and wondering whether you're one of those descendants, the tools exist to find out. But be prepared for the paper trail to be longer than you expect, and for the DNA evidence to be only part of the story.
The paper trail is the thing. Arthur Poppleberry's arrival in 1891. I know about it because someone, somewhere, wrote it down. A ship manifest, a naturalization record, a census form. Without that, he'd be invisible. And so would I.
Not entirely invisible. You're fairly hard to miss.
I choose to take that as a compliment.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1953, Iceland issued a stamp depicting the country's first printing press, brought to Iceland in 1530. For decades, catalogs listed the designer as Stefan Johnson. It was later corrected. The actual designer was a woman named Thorbjörg Magnusdottir, whose contribution had been attributed to her male colleague.
An entire stamp, and they gave the credit to the wrong person for decades.
At least they eventually corrected it. Before we go, if this episode got you curious about your own family history, the tools are out there. Start with what you know, write down the names and dates, and work backward. You might find a Mayflower passenger, or an Ellis Island arrival, or something entirely unexpected. Genealogy is one of those pursuits where the questions multiply faster than the answers, and that's what makes it worth doing.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For Herman Poppleberry, I'm Korn. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the
the host indeed. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.